Hippolyte Dumas. The Fugitive Condemned to Death. Perception of Cairan, Friday, 13th October 1797, 6:45 p.m. Mr. Dumas?
Yes.
Hyacinthe? I hear noise at the door, even though I locked it earlier. Go check it, if you have any doubt. The clerk of the tax office complied. As she approached the door, she saw that the double lock handle was showing signs of resistance. Hyacinthe had a bad feeling. At the same time, the upper hinge of the door gave way to what seemed to be a blow from an axe. She barely had time to step back before the other hinge exploded. The force of the sharp tool split the door in two. A man's face, partially covered by a poorly made cloth mask, appeared in the gaping opening, revealing two small black and determined eyes. The man began to shout,
"If you move, I'll cut you in half, just like the door."
Overcome with terror, Hyacinthe collapsed to her knees and lost consciousness on the spot. Hippolyte Dumas, impassive, remained seated at his desk as the tax collector, observing the scene with curious detachment. The young man was only 27, but already exhibited the maturity and nerve of a much older man, having gained considerable experience. He had been the mayor of Cairan, and, for a few months now, he had served as the tax collector. Standing at 6 feet 3 inches and weighing 220 pounds, with a law degree obtained in Avignon at the age of 22, Hippolyte physically commanded respect, and his mind was sharp as a razor blade. "Is this about paying taxes?" he asked ironically. The intruder leapt over what was left of the door and stepped over Hyacinthe, who lay motionless. He stood before the desk, facing Hippolyte. "Keep acting smart, and you'll never get the chance again," he growled, his finger resting on the blade of the axe as a warning. Hippolyte looked at him, almost amused. "I'm not acting smart. I'm asking because I deposited this week's collection in Orange yesterday. So tonight, the coffers are completely empty." Four other men joined the intruder, each as incredulous as him. "What? What? All right, fine. Go get the money now. I'll give you the key to the safe. It's easier. You can check for yourselves. Then you can decide whether to believe me or call me a liar." Hippolyte tossed the key, which was caught midair by one of the bandits. Greedy for potential loot, all four headed toward the safe. After some nervous attempts, they managed to open it. They were faced with the undeniable truth. "Boss, boss, it's true. There's nothing inside." The leader, with an aggressive look, sat back down in front of Hippolyte's desk. "Either you're lying, and there's another safe, in which case you die right now. Or you're telling the truth, and you might get a chance to live." After a brief reflection, Hippolyte, unshaken, used an argumentative form of blackmail. "Armand Drex, there's a third option. I don't reveal your identity to the chief marshal, who, by the way, is already aware of this incident at the tax office, and everyone walks away alive. Well, speaking figuratively, since it's only a matter of time for each of us." The man, even with half his face covered, struggled to hide his unease. After a few seconds of troubled hesitation, he replied, "You know me. What's that supposed to mean? I have a mask. You, well, you couldn't have recognized me, sir." Hippolyte smiled mischievously. "Oh, yes. I recognized you the moment you stuck your head through the broken door. Your pathetic mask stayed on the other side. By the way, your mother, the poor baker, she's Hyacinthe's cousin. The lady you scared half to death, but not for the right reasons. You must make your mother miserable, Drex. Come on, wake up. It's about time you stopped all this, isn't it? Getting ridiculous.
Ah, well, but if you recognized me, then what do we do? If I kill you, you... Oh, well, you won't be able to talk. That's what I'm thinking, right, guys? Poor Drykes didn't know where he stood anymore. One of his accomplices dared a small intervention, without much conviction. And we'd have to kill your mother's cousin, too. Yes, that's how it is. And then no one will be able to talk. Drax replied in a falsely contemptuous, disoriented, childish tone. At that moment, Hippolyte saw Hyacinthe silently get up, and, understanding his discreet gesture to leave, she slipped quietly through the broken door. The final blow was about to be dealt to the group. Yes, yes, young Drax. By the way, you started by addressing me informally. Now you're addressing me formally. Yes, you're killing me already with your words and your style. Well, never mind, I'm joking. To answer you, though, if you want to kill Hyacinthe, you'll also have to kill your mother. What? But you're crazy. I think Hyacinthe had enough time to explain everything to your mom, to the gendarmes as well, who, as we speak, are probably on their way to catch the great Charan bandits I have in front of me. All right, Mr. Dumas, I'm very interested in the third option. Actually, okay. That's reasonable. However, this option requires you and your friends to fix the door before leaving, and you'll close it by placing the key in that water trough. Do we agree? It was now a small group of embarrassed teenagers standing in front of Hippolyte, from the smallest to the tallest, almost standing at attention. Yes, sir, but the key, do I throw it in the water, the trough? Well, the fountain there, because it's full of water. No, you gently place it at the bottom. That way, your hands will be clean tonight. Drax didn't understand the metaphor. Hat on his head, Hippolyte got up to leave, asking the small group to vacate his office quickly before he closed the door in their faces. The five men worked most of the night to repair the entrance door of the tax office. It had to look brand new by the next morning when the office opened. Drax placed the key in the water trough as Hippolyte had instructed. He vigorously rubbed his hands to dry them. It was cold that night. It was 3 in the morning. As he prepared to leave, surprisingly concerned about the work his team had done, but still troubled by the evening's events, he declared to them, "Guys, tonight was my last job. I'm going home to be with my wife and kids. I don't want to steal anymore. From now on, I want to earn everything. My mother must be suffering from all this. This is it for me. I'm going straight." Perplexed, his accomplices watched him disappear into the night. The local gang had just taken a serious hit. Hippolyte had returned home a few hours earlier. The news of the failed robbery attempt at the tax office had already spread throughout the village, even at this late hour of the evening. Hyacinthe had, of course, recounted everything to the gendarmerie as well as to Mother Dryax. The mayor, Gaspard Martineau, had naturally been informed. The account of the events had circulated in no time. Hippolyte was walking home, lost in thought. He had a bad feeling. The political climate was unstable. Citizens were constantly demanding new heads to roll. The Napoleonic era encouraged the rapid rotation of elected officials. Electoral campaigns in the Drôme were often based on discrimination and lies between candidates. During the municipal election a year earlier, Hippolyte had quickly withdrawn his candidacy, disillusioned by the slanderous turn the campaign had taken. Mr. Martineau, a master of indecency, had thus been elected mayor in the absence of any political competitor. He had become an expert in manipulation. Now he was hatching every possible plan to guarantee himself an undisputed reign over the village
for several years. That evening, he saw the perfect opportunity to eliminate the most formidable potential candidate in the village, his predecessor. Hippolyte had just arrived home. He calmly removed his coat in the vestibule. "Hippolyte, is that you?" his wife Clara asked anxiously. "You won't believe what happened. You know, at the tax office tonight, young Drex." "Yes, I know, Hippolyte. But what were you thinking? We didn't need money. You know very well that money burns those who covet it excessively. But what got into you, really, to organize a robbery attempt yourself? Everyone in the village is talking about it. The gendarmerie is looking for you, and the mayor is with them." Clara's trembling voice cut off Hippolyte's affectionate smile, confirming his bad feeling. "What? What are you talking about, Clara? You need to leave, my love. Run away. Quickly." "Run away? From what? Where to?" "I don't know. But Martineau is telling anyone who'll listen that you're a bandit, and he's making it his mission to have you punished. He's looking for you with the gendarmes to arrest you." "Good heavens!" A long silence hung in the room. Hippolyte remained standing. His wife wiped away a few tears, her panic barely hidden. "I see. Martineau got the information before anyone else. His twisted mind is concocting an entire false story against me." There was a violent knock at the door. Martineau's shrill, unpleasant voice echoed in the hallway. "Citizen Dumas, surrender yourself." "Hippolyte, it's over. Everyone knew you were a brigand. Surrender now. Thief." The trap was closing. In those unstable revolutionary times, a simple accusatory testimony could send the victim to the guillotine almost immediately. Hippolyte opened the door. He observed the group of gendarmes led by the dreadful Martineau, whose worn-out pants were as dark as his gaze. Hippolyte realized there was no point in resisting. He kissed his wife and his two sons, who had just come downstairs. Dignified but sad, the two little boys hugged their father tightly. Big tears streamed down their cheeks. Amédée and Calixte, aged 10 and 8 respectively, understood the possibility of never seeing their father again. The gendarmes took the tax collector directly to the cells of the Hôtel du Peuple in Avignon, 2 hours by carriage from Cairan, with irons on his wrists. The journey in the carriage was exhausting. Hippolyte spent that very night in a dark, damp cell in Avignon. He knew the situation was highly critical and that Martineau's goal was a prolonged persecution, if not worse. All the influential political figures knew one another, from Boxwood of the Baronies to Grignan, from Montélimar to Avignon. Martineau was connected with the bigwigs of the Hôtel du Peuple, not to mention the last-minute executioners of the local crumbling revolution. They were far from the ideals of the revolution of 1792. In October 1797, France faced internal tensions caused by political factions vying for power. Tensions between the Jacobins and the Moderates, for example. Royalist uprisings in certain departments like Vaucluse. Some individuals went so far as to exploit this chaos for personal and immoral gains. A month and a half earlier, the coup of 18 Fructidor had strengthened the power of the moderate government and eliminated some royalist deputies. Hippolyte did not sleep a wink that night. He revisited his family history. The face of his father, a deputy from Cairan, reappeared, accompanied by a host of dramatic episodes: imprisonment, sentencing, unjust decision, filial trauma, unspeakable suffering, execution. The night was painful, marked by nightmares, animated by nocturnal rodents. But who had condemned his father within these same walls? who had sacrificed a pure and kind man, whose only fault was refusing immediate allegiance to a certain republic. Likely a man cut from the same cloth as Martineau, courting the Jacobin system as much as he could. By condemning François Dumas to death for treason, a dishonest judge had likely hoped for a quicker promotion from Paris. Poor Dumas père had been beheaded the day after his arrest, following a sham, hasty trial. The criminal judge, of course, received no promotion for this crime. 5 years later, he was still in the same office, driven by the same toxic ambitions. Judge Farrakh, the executor of François Dumas, would meet Hippolyte Dumas. People's Hotel in Avignon, Saturday, October 14, 1797, 7:15 a.m. After a sleepless night spent in his cell, Hippolyte, physically marked by anxiety and nightmares, was brought before an office on the upper floor of the hotel. Two gendarmes kept him under close surveillance in the corridor, his wrists bound in shackles. An hour later, he was brought into the office, where a short blonde man, buried behind mountains of files, addressed the gendarmes curtly. It was Judge Farrakh. "Keep the shackles on. I have no idea how Mr. Dumas feels might react," he declared, without looking at Hippolyte. "Have him sit in the chair in front of me. Sir, I see in your file that you used your position for personal gain, in association with criminals. Fortunately for us, Mayor Martineau ensures the state's protection in Cairan." Hippolyte was as pale as a sheet. "There are very few mitigating circumstances in your case. You will undergo a special procedure, and I will be your sole judge, given the situation. As a sole judge, and on a personal note, I consider that your behavior clearly and undeniably constitutes treason against the state." After a long and gloomy silence, convinced of Judge Farrakh's insincerity, Hippolyte responded in a weak voice. "Judge, your accusations are based solely on Mayor Martineau's false claims. Surely you must realize that there's no way I could have colluded with the brigand Shay. If that had been the case, I wouldn't be sitting before you. The operation would have succeeded." The judge no longer looked at Hippolyte, who continued, his voice emotional. "Before becoming a tax collector, I was the mayor. I've never failed in my obligations or duties. You must know this. This situation is absurd. Let's put an end to it. Free me." "Free you? And what's next? I've been told you've got humor embedded in your very being." "Indeed, I see it now." More assertive, the magistrate raised his voice. "The question of the charge's validity is not up for debate, dear sir. The strength of the accusation's motive is at my sole discretion, and I believe one element will not work in your favor, your family's inheritance. That, in my view, is the foundation of the case."
"What? What?"
shouted Hippolyte. "Since my decision regarding you is made, I'll tell you. I'm the judge who investigated and convicted your father." "My father was found guilty in an unjust trial, without a lawyer. And you were the judge." Hippolyte's fury exploded. With a violent kick, he sent a chair flying to the other side of the room. He grabbed a lamp from the desk and hurled it at the judge. It missed its target. One of the two gendarmes, startled, gripped the handle of his sword, while the other struck Hippolyte in the face. Judge Farrakh's calm only added to his treachery. He seemed to savor the situation. "Indeed, Mr. Dumas, it was I who dealt with your father's case, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Same cause, same effect. You'll pass on my regards to him wherever you're headed. Gentlemen, take the prisoner back to his cell. I'll deliver the verdict this afternoon." The gendarmes came close to knocking out Hippolyte, who was screaming and flailing with all his might. The sign at the entrance to the corridor, where they threw him, left no room for doubt. Condemned to death. His life expectancy had been reduced to mere hours. The rest was already written. Unless an escape could succeed, Hippolyte knew it. 1 a.m., the cells were silent. The guards, that weekend, were not particularly vigilant. The previous evening's festivities, in honor of the coup d'etat of 18 Fructidor, had ushered in a Saturday of drinking. The night had plunged them into sleep. Hippolyte had been placed in a temporary cell since the morning. Strangely, the lock's typically loud mechanism made no sound. Alone in his cell, he had all day to think about how to escape during the night. He hoped no guard would notice the poorly locked door left slightly ajar. In the dead of night, Hippolyte took the powder of escape. For his survival and for the memory of his father. His escape from the Hôtel du Peuple in Avignon met no obstacles. It was discreet and sure, thanks to a brave winemaker he encountered on the road to Avignon, with his cart loaded with empty barrels. The executioner, whose name was already recorded on the judgment, never laid hands on Hippolyte's head. Sunday morning, at 11 a.m., lying among the empty casks, the fugitive heard his benefactor angel say, "Well, my friend, we've arrived in Grignan. It's time to get off." "Thank you, sir. You've saved my life." "I don't know. Maybe one day you'll do the same for me. Good luck. Try the Grand Monarch Inn. I've heard they have a few rooms for rent upstairs." Hippolyte climbed down from the cart at the foot of Grignan's castle. He'd heard of it before, but was taken aback by the advanced decay of this feudal residence, born in the 11th century. Piles of stones, half-torn windows, and columns of smoke rose from all sides. The Grand Monarch Inn was a few hundred meters away. Hippolyte was anxious. He thought of his wife Clara, of Calixte, and of Amédée. The Mistral winds continued to dry his tears. When would he see them again? What would become of them all? Grignan, Grand Monarch Inn, Sunday, November 15th, 10:05 a.m. Lost in his somber thoughts, hesitating, he walked toward the inn. His dusty, wrinkled clothes betrayed the agitated cold night he had just endured. The straw had offered no comfort during the frantic cart ride. The village seemed deserted, and the atmosphere was almost oppressive. As he entered the inn, he was greeted by a burly man with a closed face, who eyed him with suspicion. "What do you want?" the man asked gruffly. "A room, just for a few days. I've fled unjust threats," Hippolyte replied, trying to gain the innkeeper's sympathy. "Oh, unjust threats, huh? You're not the first stranger to show up with that story. Got money to pay? Is this enough?" The paltry sum of coins made the innkeeper sneer. "Just enough for one night. And even then, I'm taking a risk letting you stay. No trouble, understood?" Hippolyte acquiesced. He was taken upstairs to a small room where he hoped to spend the day and the night. No sooner had he closed the door than shouts and dull thuds echoed through the corridor. The innkeeper was banging furiously on his door.
"Is that you, Dumas?"
"Yes," Hippolyte replied instantly. "Get out immediately. Soldiers just passed by and said they're actively searching for a man named Dumas, a fugitive from Avignon. If you're found here, it's the end for me, too." Hippolyte rushed to the window, seeing that it opened onto a narrow alleyway watched by military patrols. As he hesitated, the manager burst through the door and yanked him by the sleeve. They rushed down to the kitchen. The innkeeper pushed open a trap door leading to a secret cellar. "Stay here until things calm down.
but don't think you can stay for long. You're going to get me in trouble here." The man growled, panicking as he resurfaced, just as soldiers burst into the main hall upstairs. "Where is he?" a soldier shouted, flinging open the inn's door. "I haven't seen your fugitive, poor." Hippolyte, in the damp cellar filled with wine barrels and cobwebs, tried to hold his breath. He could hear the soldier's energetic steps above him. Another sound came from within the cellar, a silhouette faintly lit by a candle. "Who's there?" Hippolyte whispered. "It's me, the cook. This way, quickly. Run, young man, to the outer trap door." The brave woman opened another trap door hidden at the back of the cellar, leading outside behind the inn. Hippolyte barely managed to whisper his thanks before rushing into the fresh air. He could now hear the clamor from the inn more distinctly. The soldiers were still inside. The deep darkness, though kind, allowed him to make out a vast field in front of him. He had to flee immediately. Clearly, the old village of Grignan did not offer the refuge he'd hoped for. As he vanished into the shadows of the hills, his enemies seemed to multiply. He chose paths cutting through the forest. Where could he hide? He followed a stream to avoid getting lost. Grignan, the Abyss of La Bear, Sunday, September 15th, 12:30 p.m. For 2 hours, Hippolyte had been walking. He had followed the stream toward Tolignan before realizing that the houses were becoming scarce and the dense vegetation was becoming impassable. Having turned back, he was now approaching the place known as the Abyss of the Bearer. Exhausted, he zigzagged through thickets, stumbled over riverside rocks. Brambles scratched him. Brooms and wild laurels slapped him. His mind swirled between despair and determination. By noon, it was hot. Hippolyte was hungry and at the end of his strength. Each step grew heavier. As he turned a corner on a narrow little wooden bridge, he spotted the outline of a tall stone building with thick walls. It overlooked a large pond. A magnificent forest stretched behind it, bordering a meadow. The place exuded an aura, both mysterious and soothing. The river seemed to have made its home there. Its bed disappeared just behind the mysterious residence, as if it entered and never came out. It was the Raymond Mill. As he approached, Hippolyte heard the babbling of water on the mill wheels. Below the access path, on the first banks of the pond, he sat cautiously in the shade of an old olive tree with a double trunk. Its bark was thick, its foliage lush. On one of its branches, the name Constantine was clearly carved. The large, exposed roots of the hospitable tree offered him the comfort of an upholstered armchair. Panalis Raymond, a man of character and master alchemist, was scanning the horizon from the doorway of the building. His sharp eyes had spotted the young traveler. He observed him from afar. Hippolyte, for his part, had not seen him. Courteously, Panalis called out to him from afar. His voice was gentle, assured, with a touch of authority. "You seem exhausted, young traveler. This olive tree is called Constantin? I have the feeling it has adopted you. Come in, enter, and share in our hospitality." Hippolyte looked at Panalis in silence. The young traveler burst into tears to the point of choking. From uncertainty to hope, his heart spun like the wheel of the mill. He wanted to speak, to tell his story, but the words remained stuck in his throat. Weakened, he finally nodded. Panalis spoke to him even more softly, troubled by the deep sadness that overwhelmed his young interlocutor. "Life is not all sweetness, nor is it all suffering. It is what it is, and we must accept it as such." Panalis approached and lifted Hippolyte.
he supported him to the entrance of the Bastide. The two men entered the reception room of the house. A large fireplace stood before them. The pot hanging from the iron hook released a soft smoke. Panalis placed Hippolyte in a large leather armchair in the corner of the room. He slipped away for a moment to bring him fresh water, a glass of wine, crusty bread, a plate, and cutlery. Millers, dressed in their aprons, bustled around on the floor below. Panalis sat down in front of Hippolyte, who devoured his meal. "My name is Panalis Raymond. I am the owner of this estate. Welcome to the mill. You will be able to regain your strength, young traveler," he said in an almost affectionate tone, handing him a glass of wine. Hippolyte oscillated between gratitude, confusion, and amazement at such spontaneous hospitality and generosity. Could this place and this man be entirely safe? Panalis allowed his guest the time he needed to eat. He observed him. His wife, Adele, appeared at the foot of the staircase near the fireplace. She carried a gray cat in her arms, very affectionate. A feeling of calm washed over Hippolyte, like a soft surge of energy. He realized that he had not yet introduced himself. His hosts, however, already seemed to know him after only a few exchanges in this strange room, which resembled a cabinet of curiosities. Adele suggested that he go rest in a room upstairs. "Rest," she said, with somewhat surprising conviction. "But I don't know if I can," he stammered, touched by her kindness. They climbed the subtly crafted wooden staircase to the right of the fireplace. She opened a cozy room for him and wished him a good rest, placing the keys on a small, stylish chest of drawers. He sank into the thick sheets of the bed and fell asleep immediately. When he woke up the next day, the first rays of the sun lit up his room, with the soft purring of the cat as background music, comfortably settled at the foot of the bed. The cat stretched its morning stretch at the same time as him. Hippolyte stepped onto the porch of the Bastide. From there, he could observe the entire estate, its pond, and its forest. In the distance, he saw Panalis, busy giving instructions to some farmers who were threshing wheat under the clear blue Provençal sky. The sight was magnificent. All his senses were alert. He felt at peace. His heart full of gratitude, he waved to Panalis and hurried to join him. Upon greeting him, he thanked the mill owner once again for his hospitality. Without really knowing why, he found himself sharing fragments of the troubling dreams that had marked his long sleep. Touched and intrigued, Panalis listened carefully to the account of these strange nocturnal visions. After a brief moment of reflection, Panalis, with a tone of compassion and hidden joy, addressed Hippolyte. "It seems that the dream journey of this very long night is the harbinger of a new path, a more reconstructive journey for you and yours. Have you ever heard of philosophical alchemy?" These words resonated strangely in Hippolyte's mind. He had just crossed the threshold of an enticing, though uncertain, future. He clearly felt that the Raymond Mill and its owners held the key to it all.